Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, and Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, and you're also listening to Melody and Alfred saying, are we on? I don't know, but I think we are. But thank you for joining us this afternoon, and we are here to bring you opinion and commentary on today's economic and political events on Thursday, February 6, 2014. And of course, we got a lot of things to talk about today, and we're going to have Wendy Wilson joining us for the first segment of the program today, and hopefully she's there standing by, but we'll muddle through this one way or another. And what's that mean, Al? Anyway, let's go ahead and go right to the markets today. You can type him a little note out and find out to exactly where we're at. In the meantime, let me tell the listeners where our gold is today. Basically, same as yesterday, 1258. It was all over the page today, had a high of 1267. They beat it down to 1252, and we're right here at almost 1259. So, fair day for gold. Silver up 5 cents at 20.05. Platinum was down 3 at 13.83. And we have palladium up 2 at $715. USDX today. It's odd to see gold down or basically unchanged. The U.S. broke down 0.18 at 80.89. Crude oil is climbing back up 46 cents today at 97.84. And the paper markets today, woohoo, big day in the paper markets. They will have a big day until tomorrow. But let's see what we did. It's the biggest gain in 2014 in a whole month, rising 188 points. Mainly you had Disney. They climbed 5% on their earnings. Twitter had a good day, tumbled 24%. The Nasdaq's 15,628. The Nasdaq was up 45 at 4,057. The S&P was up 21 at 1773, and the 10-year yield is beginning to creep slowly back up, 2.70%, up 0.03. And there you have it, folks. You're listening to Financial Survival, and Wendy Wilson is joining us. She is standing by. Good afternoon, Wendy.
Good afternoon, Melody. How are you guys doing?
Just
good.
Fine.
Awesome. Well, we're going to talk about February being the big flu month, because that's what everybody says. Do you think it is? Well, we're going to find out. Now, lots of people get Valentine's and chocolates, but Valentine's Day is the only thing that happens in February. Last year, Al, Melody, 166 million people got flu shots, so about 60% of the U.S. population got the flu shot. And we're told that February has the highest risk of getting colds and flus. Now, 41 states currently are reporting lots of flu cases. And with the exception of Hawaii and Iowa, which have the lowest reporting, and do you want to take a guess why?
Which two states?
Hawaii and Iowa.
No, I can't guess why. I don't see the common denominator.
Well, if you go to the CDC website, they do have a flu vaccination map on how many, the percentages of the population getting the flu vaccine. And Iowa and Hawaii have not reached that 50% vaccination saturation point yet. Also, Google, did you know that Google reports on internet searches regarding flu topics? And they report that to the CDC. It's called Google's Flu Trends. And the government thinks Google can report faster statistics than the traditional reporting systems, and that helps the government keep on top of the stats. Also, the government does track over-the-counter cold and flu remedy sales as another form of statistics for the cold and flu season. But what's really interesting is I wanted to know why.
They also track why, it so much.
Well, yeah. Well, and, you know, and I wanted to know why people who say, you know, I got the flu shot and then I got the flu, I wanted to find out a little bit about that. But first I found out statistics have been on – these have been published forever, statistics on the decline of disease before vaccines were even developed. But most people didn't take the publication seriously because the majority of that was reported by statisticians, mathematicians, but not doctors. However, the International Medical Council on Vaccinations, which is supported by physicians, was reporting on flu vaccines. And they say that the flu vaccine makes you more vulnerable to virus infections. They report that there was a 90% decrease in deaths from flu and pneumonia prior to the flu vaccines being rolled out. And all these facts were reported to the CDC in 2003 and were published in the Journal of Vaccine. And I want to read you two little entries from that journal. This is a quote: national influenza-related mortality rates among seniors increased in the 1980s and 90s as the senior vaccination coverage quadrupled. The results of the review seem to discourage the utilization of vaccination against influenza in healthy adults as routine public health measures, end of quote. So what the CDC was expecting, Al and Melody, was when they rolled out these flu vaccines in the 70s and 80s, that they wanted to see a 35 to 40% reduction in mortality, but what they found was a zero reduction in mortality due to flu vaccines. So the flu vaccine wasn't stopping the mortality rates from flu. What do you think of that?
But it was still generating generous profits for the major pharmaceutical companies. Absolutely. Is that true or false?
Well, and Dr. Peter Dashi, he weighed in on that review in 2003, and his comments were published in 2005. He said this: public officials only need to claim that the vaccine saves lives and that most people, including doctors, assume there is solid research behind the claim, but unfortunately, this is not the case, end of quote. So the Cochrane vaccine field, they also published some statistics in 2009. And this was interesting. Their research reported that during the winter months, there's like 7 to 11% of the cases are actually the flu. 93% are actually mere colds or rhinoviruses. So in reality, there's a small percentage of the pathogens that are genuine influenza. So you might be asking, well, why, if influenza is relatively rare by comparison, why are a majority of the cases, you know, are we seeing a push for flu vaccines and they're harvesting new flu viruses and strains? Well, it's simple. When medicine uses vaccines to protect you from the flu, you are really being injected with the flu. So in 2012, they reported on the flu vaccines being used. And they said the flu shot offers recipients a 5 times higher risk of getting rhinoviruses. And rhinoviruses, as you know, can sometimes mimic flu symptoms. So that's why people sometimes say, you know, I got the flu from the flu shot. And they said that there's some unknown biological mechanism in the flu vaccine, which reduces your immunity, and then it makes you more vulnerable to catching the cold. So, and what was even more weird is in these double-blind placebo tests for flu shots, they you know what they use for the placebo, Al, Melanie? Want to take a guess?
Coca-Cola.
They use the hepatitis A vaccine as a placebo.
Oh, my God. What we're talking about here, at least in part, we are suggesting, or we appear to be, we appear to be suggesting that the sale of flu vaccines is essentially based on fraud.
Yeah.
If I'm understanding what you're saying right now, for every 100 individuals who buy a flu vaccine shot, only about 11 of them are likely to get flu in the first place. The other 90 might have a cold, but they weren't going to get the flu no matter what happened.
Well, here's the problem. See, the CDC lumps pneumonia in with influenza, and it's not, and it shouldn't be. They do that to pump up their numbers is what they do. But in the 70s, the death rate by flu was 20 to 25 people per 100,000 nationwide. And all that changed in the 80s when the flu vaccines were used, and that went to 30 people per 100,000. So, well, if you want to know about fraud, let me read you this quote by Dr. Gary Farthman. He's the professor and associate director of immunology and rheumatology at the Institute of Immunology, Transplantation, and Infection. And he's an immunologist with over 40 years' experience in his field. He says this: the immune system remains a black box. We are still doing the same test I did when I was a medical student in the late 60s. It's staggeringly complex with tens of thousands of genes. It's an awful lot of moving parts, and we don't really know what the vast majority of them do. We can't even be sure how to tell when the immune system's not working right, let alone why not, because we don't have any good metrics of what a healthy immune system looks like. We don't even know what an immune stimulant even means. End of quote. So you want
to see science admit that they don't really know what's going on. They understand how much to charge for the shot, though, don't they?
Well, if they don't know what an immune stimulant even means, why do they fill up these vaccines with adjuvants to stimulate the immune system?
The whole thing, it really does sound like charlatans are running the medical establishment. And they're just, it doesn't matter. They're just, get the money, make a sale. Here, have a vaccine.
It's sort of like politics right now. They're lying out everywhere, and it's just, you know, oh, well. It's, everybody's, you know, expecting it. I don't know. But, you know, basically, I think the flu vaccine's primary goal is to suppress immune system. Like they admitted, the researchers said that it has some sort of weird mechanism where it does make you 5 times more vulnerable to infections like rhinoviruses. So that's its primary goal, is suppress immune system. And I've also read research from other physicians in the field that, you know, if you keep doing that, You pretty much break an immune system with all this suppression. It just
That was one of the questions I was going to have, that I was going to pose, is you pointed out that the flu shots, there's research that suggests that they actually reduce your immune system. How long does that reduction persist? Are we talking about a reduction in your immune system efficiency for the month of February? Are we talking 3-4 months? Are we talking a year? How long does the immune system remain suppressed once you've taken the shot? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I would say a minimum of 14 to 24 days.
Okay, so, well, that's not, at least it's not permanent.
Well, that's initially.
From my perspective, if they're only going to shut my immune system off for 2 weeks, you know, for me, that's cause for celebration. I was afraid they were going to shut it off for 6 months or a year, and if I took another shot after that, it might be permanently shut off forever. But if it's only 12 to 14 days, and I don't mean to make light of it, that's still a bad problem. It's inexcusable.
Well, that's your initial introduction to vaccines is when you start taking vaccines regularly every year, you get an accumulative effect. So eventually you paralyze the immune system, and it's paralyzed. It's going to stay that way. The immune system's kind of like a muscle, and if you want to atrophy a muscle, it's not going to work. You're not going to run the marathon with an atrophied muscle. So when you need your immune system work, it won't. So that's what I'm saying. People need to educate themselves. You know, my people perish for lack of knowledge. I believe that. So,
yeah, absolutely.
And I thought
all right,
that would
be. You've got a problem with the vaccines.
Yeah.
Do we have a legitimate problem that we have to be concerned about, or is it more in our mind about flu in February?
No, it's both, actually. See, what happens is, you know, you've got a lot of people that are shedding flu viruses even when they do get vaccinated. Dr. Carley even confirmed that. And so, and then you have suppressed immune systems. And so you've got people that there's, you know, the flu viruses have been able to circulate. And of course, the rhinoviruses have been able to circulate. And what do people do in February that further suppresses their immune system out?
Well, I don't know. I have no
chocolate.
Idea.
They eat Valentine's Day chocolate with lots of sugar. And
I was going to say that, but I thought that was even too goofy for me.
Well, anyway, February usually is the worst month for colds and flu, and I just want to alert everybody out there to beef up their immune system. And right now they can power up and save 20% with the formulas for immune boosting at the powerherbs.com website. And they can do their pets a favor and power them up with the Power Greens for pets. And you just add that to their pet food, and all the minerals and nutrition and enzymes that are cooked out of the pet food, you can put back in with organic plants. And that's the Power Greens for pets. And so they can check us out online at thepowerherbs.com, or they can call toll-free for a free product catalog at 866-229-3663. That's 24/7, 866-229-3663. And I think next time, Al, I want to talk about health under observation. There's some new rules for Medicaid and Medicare patients in the Affordable Care Act that they aren't aware of, and their hospitals and doctors don't have to tell them about this loophole.
All right. We'll look forward to hearing about that. But before we let you go, why don't you give us an idea of what is in the products you provide that might be useful to stop the flu this time of year?
Absolutely. Basically, the immune system responds to nutrition. And so herbs are powerful nutrition powerhouses that support different functions of the body. So you'll want to tap into some of the immune-stimulating herbs that help the immune system do what it does, but more efficiently, which makes killer T cells from macrophages, which are your white blood cells, and they circulate around the body more effectively. So what you're doing is you're heightening your resistance. And for a lot of people who have suppressed immune systems, when they use immune-boosting herbs like echinacea and astragalus root and garlic, what they're doing is bringing their immune system up back up to normal level. So people need a lot of work out there. They just don't know it. And so God's Good Herbs are here to help, so they can check us out online. thepowerherbs.com.
What about, you say they don't know, they don't understand the dimension of their own problem. Do you sell or do you recommend any of those kits where you can find out how short you are on minerals, for example? And we've got 15 seconds, Wendy.
Yeah, we do have lots of kits, power herb kits. We do have an effective 3 Amigo pack, which is the synergistic effect of building on nutrition and immune system boosting. And everybody's going to be low on minerals, vitamins, and so forth because our foods are so depleted. So boosting that with some natural intake isn't going to hurt.
Okay, Wendy, thanks very much. We'll talk to you next Thursday. Look forward to it. That's Wendy Wilson from thepowerherbs.com. Melody and I will be back on Financial Survival in about 3 minutes. Please stay tuned.
Pandemics will be a part of our future. The question is, how do we protect ourselves? Are you willing to put your trust in untested vaccine, hoping it kills mutating viruses? Remember, in 1976, health officials tried to inoculate Americans with swine flu, and there was a 300% death rate for those inoculated, and millions were paid out in damages. God gave you a sophisticated immune system, and in times of need, you can make it 10 times stronger. So there's no need to panic. Just get prepared. Call Apothecary Herbs to order your upgraded pandemic kit. You will have 8 professional strength formulas offering broad-spectrum immune-boosting protection. Take a stand, have a plan, have peace, and request your pandemic kit today. Call Apothecary Herbs toll-free, 866-229-3663, or online, thepowerherbs.com. That's 866-229-3663, or thepowerherbs.com.
Food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis, here on Financial Survival with Melody Cederstrom. Programs brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver. What's next, Melody?
I want to bring to the listeners today, we're going to continue the special with Mid-State 62, Saints and Liberties. Actually, the Saints, the Liberties went up a little bit in price. Over the Saints, not by much, but we're going to continue to offer both of them for $1,460 for Men's State 62, $20 gold pieces. Either Saints or Liberties, give us a call at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. These are Men's State 62, $20 gold pieces. Either the $20 Liberty or the $20 St. Gaudens. And, of course, the Liberties, a lot of those dates are minted prior to, well, both of them are minted prior to 1933. And, of course, the Liberties are the older of the two. Mainly the dates in the St. Gaudens you'll receive will be in the 20s. But they're both very beautiful coins, and it can be your selection. Which you would like, just pick up the phone and give us a call. And, of course, visit our website at dgscoins.com. DGS for Discount Gold Silver Coins, coins.com. And I know, Al, there's dealers out there that they promote a lot of the circulated $20 gold pieces. And the $5 circulated gold piece is my favorite fractional piece for a small bartering type coin. That is my favorite because there is a big spread between a almost uncirculated and a mint state. I mean, you're looking at, if you purchase four of them, that would equal almost an ounce. You're looking at a couple hundred dollars. That's a big spread. But when it comes to the $20 gold pieces between a Mint State 61 and a circulated coin, you're only looking at about $40-$50.
Yeah.
So folks, why bother with an extra fine circulated $20 gold piece when you could pick up a Mint State 62 for, $30, $40, $50? And the prices these dealers charge are far greater than what I charge for my Mint State coins. And for the $20 gold pieces, I've always called those my opinion coins because they're circulated. And when you go to sell them back, many times you will, it's the opinion of the person to whom you're selling them to as far as how they value them. But it's, I'm not saying a lot of dealers do this, but I have found when folks sell me back extra fine coins that they purchased elsewhere that, you know, you can get VFs in there. You can get damaged coins, and they'll just mix them all up. They polish them. They're shiny. They're pretty. And everybody thinks they're getting a great deal until you go to sell them back. And then you'll get hammered. So give me a call if you have any questions.
Okay. What shall we, let's hear something from Mark Faber, who has achieved a certain amount of renown around the world as an investor and commentator and so on. He says the market, referring to the stock market, is way overdue for a 20 to 30% drop. And he goes on to say he hopes the market drops 40%. So stocks will become, from a value point of view, attractive. He also complains quantitative easing is a complete failure. It has lifted asset prices and created asset inflation, but it hasn't lifted the standard of living for most people in the U.S. nor worldwide. But he does say, again, Faber is not a prophet. He can't tell us absolutely what is happening or what should happening, but he's no dummy. I believe he's a billionaire. I'm not sure if that's true, but I believe he's a billionaire. He says the market is way overdue for a 20 to 30% drop. Now, why do you suppose the stocks, the stock market is way overdue for a 20 to 30% drop, Melody?
Why is it ready for a 20 to 30% drop?
Way overdue.
It's way overdue. Yeah. Should have never even gone up.
Well, it's because it's been artificially supported by quantitative easing.
By the Federal Reserve.
That's part of the reason for it. Mm-hmm. If that artificial push weren't there, we would have seen, assuming Faber is correct in his analysis, we would have seen a fall in the stock market, a significant fall prior to now. And why is it way overdue? Because the government has maintained it. Here's another one. Shocking U.S. factory orders and Chinese bank woes trigger global flight to safety. This is from The Telegraph in England, an article written by Ambrose Evans Pritchard. Pritchard is a good guy. I don't know if you, I never met the man, of course. I've had no correspondence. But I've admired the man for years because he got thrown out of the United States under the Bush administration. They wanted him out of here because he was exposing too much about our government, so they threw him out and sent him back to England. So, yeah, you know, I admire him. I think he's a good guy and so on. He reports that factory orders in the United States suffered their steepest fall for 33 years in January. What's America's Institute for Supply Management's ISM index dropped from 56.5 to 51.3 in January, the biggest one-month decline since the Lehman crisis. Stephen Roach from Yale University said the American households had not yet finished the epic purge needed to bring borrowing levels back to historic levels. The debt-to-income ratio has dropped from 135%, meaning... Well, I'm not absolutely the debt to income. They were in debt for 135% of their income. That's what it meant. Coming up to 2008 or 2007, and it's dropped from 135% to 109% most recently. But he says it still has another 35 percentage points to go to get back to historic levels, which implies, where are we? A healthy, perhaps, or at least historically tolerable debt level for the American people would be something in the neighborhood of 70% of your income. All right, if you were in debt for 70% of your income, apparently that's a historical level that is sustainable, but 135% is not, 109%, which is where we are now, not. So he goes on and he says American consumers' balance sheet repair is at best only about half finished. And this implies that it's going to take several more years before the economy regains its footing. Morgan Stanley warned that there are widespread concerns over an estimated $1.1 trillion in foreign currency debt owed by China. All right? Now that surprises me. I would have thought China, with its massive reserves, cash reserves in U.S. dollars and U.S. treasuries and so on, I wouldn't think they were borrowing any money. And yet it turns out China has a $1.1 trillion foreign currency debt owed by Chinese banks and companies. That's interesting to me because I just wouldn't have thought, why would they be going into debt if they had masses of their own capital? It's a little surprising.
They're the government, but the banks and companies, I mean, that's why they have all these cities that are vacant. I mean, their corruption in their banking system and everything is,
Maybe we could trade them. We got a lot of vacant space in Detroit, and they've got a lot of vacant buildings. Maybe we could work something out where we could trade them some of the debris from Detroit, and they could trade us some of the buildings from their vacant cities.
They have a lot of shadow banking going on over there, so surprise me. But
well, this list from Ambrose Evans Pritchard, that's certainly a strongly English name. It's just, here's another one. The U.S. labor participation rate is still at a 50-year low of 62.8%, evidence of a jobless recovery. He's got a few more items on here, but the point behind this is he's just laying on a list of the problems that are facing the United States. Got another article here, Greek economist Kostas Lapavitsas. All right, I'm not going to try to send this. I won't try to embarrass myself by saying that again during the course of this interview, but he's the guy we're quoting. He has an article, the euro has already failed. And in 2012, Mario Draghi stated the European Central Bank is ready to do whatever it takes to preserve the euro, and believe me, it will be enough. That was a year and a half ago. I guess I will see here, I have to say it again. But the Greek economist Kostas Lapavitsas, he says, however, the European Central Bank is not the solution. What happened in 2011 and 2012 is that the peripheral countries accepted austerity demanded by Berlin and Brussels. By peripheral countries, he means Greece, for example, and Spain. And there were countries we talked about, Portugal, Italy to some degree, they accepted some of the austerity demanded by Berlin and Brussels. They accepted wage cuts and unemployment. Their economies headed for a recession. The fundamental answer for them is recession. But he says now the euro crisis has moved to the heart of the eurozone. France and Italy are now facing the same problems as the peripheral countries in the European Union faced in 2010 and 2011. The crisis is now in France and Italy. France is now a situation impossible. He goes on to list the problems we have that they see in Europe. And he concludes, at least in part, he says, in fact, the euro has already failed. It was a project that was supposed to create convergence, growth, and solidarity between the peoples of Europe. It was supposed to create a commodity among the Europeans. Excuse me. It was supposed to create a commonality among Europeans. Instead, the euro has created divergence, recession, poverty. It's like a straitjacket for Europe. It increases the national and social tensions in Europe. It succeeds now only because it instills fear. I don't think it's sustainable for long. It's interesting to me that the purpose of the fiat euro to create commonality among Europeans is somewhat similar to an alleged justification for the fiat dollar first issued by the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, back in the early 1900s. It was to promote a stronger economic union among the states. We would get that common currency used throughout the United States, and that common currency would, in theory, bind us together and make us a stronger nation. In both instances, however, both the euro for Europe and the fiat dollar for the United States, both of them are fiat currencies. The result for both fiat currencies has been much the same. They've both, quote, created divergences, recession, poverty, and increased national and social tensions. Now, some of that is not yet visible, but it will be before this is all over. Ms. Shedlock commented on this article. He says, I agree with the economist Lapavitsas on major points. The euro has already failed. The question is, when will that be politically recognized? Now, that's a brilliant question. And the reason is, there's all sorts of information that's available. All right? We can see things. We talk about things on this program that seem to us, at least, to be powerful and important information that point to inevitable problems that we have that we're going to have to confront. And yet, people don't seem to pay close attention. The question becomes, when will these issues, these arguments, these facts be politically recognized? Because in a strange and bizarre sense, the world continues to function. It's a little like the, you know, some aeronautical engineers studied the bumblebee and said, aerodynamically speaking, that insect can't fly. Well, the bumblebee doesn't know it can't fly, so it has no problem flying. It just flies around, despite the fact that it's not aerodynamically correct. Well, to some degree, economies are like that. Nations are like that. To the extent that we believe everything is all right, well, everything holds together, and everything seems to be all right. And this is why government tries to instill confidence in the American people and tries to say, oh, we got a recovery. It's taking place. Everything's great. Everything's rosy. They need to instill that confidence, and they need to stop us from the political recognition where we sit back and say, holy cow, did you see what's happening here? They're trying to keep us calm. And the question becomes, should we, Melody, on the radio program, try to keep people calm and maintain a false confidence? Or should we try to alert people to real problems that are there and are sure to bite us sooner or later?
Well, I don't think it's our job. I think it's our job to report the truth as we see it. And so people, hopefully they take heed and do what they need to do to prepare. They need to protect themselves and their families. And, you know, he said the question is, when will the fiat be politically recognized? Well, I believe it is politically recognized. They're doing everything possible. They know it's a failed currency, and they're doing what they need to do to still it. You're right, the economies continue to go, but that's because it's being pushed and held up by the European Union. So politically, I think it is recognized, wouldn't you say?
Well, it's recognized by the people in power, but they're doing their level best to keep the great unwashed from recognizing
it. So it is recognized politically. It's just the people.
Yeah.
And even the people might know. It's just not commonly accepted.
Yeah, that's the thing. And so the problem just grows, and we're trying to sit back and say, wait a second, we've got a problem here. Somebody needs to hit the brakes. Somebody needs to change direction. And if the public, even though the government, in my opinion, understands what we're talking about and perhaps even agrees with what we're talking about, they're still trying to keep everybody deceived into the idea that everything's under control. Don't pay no attention to the little man behind the curtain. And I think that's dangerous. From my perspective, it's dangerous. We've got to give people the truth of the matter and let them make their own decisions and verify. We'll tell you what we think. You go ahead and look around and see if you agree with our assessment and our analysis. We're going to take another break for some commercials. We'll be back in a moment. I'm Alfred Addis, Melody Cederstrom, Financial Survival. Please stay tuned.
Countries have denied internet access for their people during civil strife. The FCC seized in-use commercial shortwave frequencies right after the September 11th attacks. No one communication system can be depended on to be there when you need information. You need choices. You need a KU band free-to-air satellite system from AVR. The AVR system includes a receiver, an LNB, and a 75-centimeter dish. All you need to get on your own is the coaxial cable. The system is delivered to your door for $149.99. That's right, delivered for $149.99. That's the shipping and the system, $149.99. Call 541-225-4659. That's 541-225-4659. Or visit AmericanVoiceRadio.com and click Satellite System.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it. Nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on American Voice Radio Network and Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Hi, folks. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cedarstrom on Financial Survival. We've got a caller, David from Indiana. David, are you there?
Yes. Yes, sir. Hey, I was wondering with that commonality talk, are we talking commonality or are we talking dependence?
Yeah, it's a sales pitch. It's a sales pitch. It was a sales pitch then, you know, and that's all it was. It wasn't real, but it sounds good.
If I were China and I was holding a lot of long-term U.S. debt and bonds, and that money's locked up because you can't dump it without dumping the value of the bonds worldwide, why wouldn't I go out and borrow dollars on the open market where I can trade and actually purchase things because the debt there in dollars is backed by the debt owed in bonds? A dollar is a dollar.
It's not necessarily a bad idea. Some people are doing that. They're taking advantage of whatever credit they have to go out and buy tangible properties that they think will serve them well when the dollar goes into inflation and perhaps even hyperinflation and allows you to perhaps pay off the debt with much cheaper dollars. But, you know, it's a risky business. You start going into debt in order to buy things. You know, you're making a bet. This isn't just investing. This is speculating and gambling. And if you have the resources to do it and you're sure that you're not going to be hurt if things don't work out for you, then it's perhaps an acceptable idea. But
if you have the debt obligation through the bond, and you got to hold on to the bond or you drive bond prices down, and there's still a fluid money market out there, that dollar U.S. bond is equal to any dollar amount since there's actually, in Black's Law anyway, there's no value to the dollar anyway, so you're just dealing with a terminology, dollar to dollar.
Well, when you get into the bonds,
safe hedge.
From my perspective, I'm not absolutely certain that you're talking about United States Treasury bonds. Is that what you're talking about right now?
Yeah, long-term U.S. bonds, like they want to hit us with their annuities, taking away the retirement funds.
I understand.
Annuities.
What I think is this. We're sitting in a situation where there is too much debt. The entire debt can't possibly be repaid. All right, national debt, according to the government, $17.2 trillion. According to again, John Williams at ShadowStats.com, $90 trillion. The debt, if Williams is right, and I think he is, the debt can't possibly be paid. The problem is all of the debt is memorialized with pieces of paper, paper debt instruments, where I borrowed $100,000 from the bank, and the bank has a piece of paper with my signature on it that says I'm going to pay them $100,000 plus interest. Relatively speaking, that's what people are holding those pieces of paper and treating them as assets. But if it turns out that the debt can't be paid, those paper assets, the value will just it'll vaporize. There's no telling how much will be lost, but I don't think we can pay for more than 10 or 20% of the existing debt. And if I'm right, the average person storing his wealth in the form of a piece of paper sooner or later is going to lose 80 to 90% of the wealth that he stored in that piece of paper. The debt can't be paid. And the great significance of that, the debt itself in its own way is irrelevant. What's relevant is all of the paper assets that correspond to the debt. The debt can't be paid. The paper value of the bonds that are being held by pension funds and retirement funds and banks and other institutions and foreign lenders and private individuals, those bonds are going to turn out to be worthless. And it's not that we lose the debt, it's that we lose the corresponding assets. And once those assets are gone, where do we find the money that we're going to borrow to build the next little shopping center down the street or start up another new business or buy a new car? When those bonds disappear, the assets disappear. That's the danger of this fiat monetary system. We lose the debt. We can't get rid of the debt without also losing assets. If we cancel the national debt, $17.2 trillion officially, we also cancel $17.2 trillion of paper assets in this country. It would probably be enough to send us into a depression that we would not escape in the near future. We can't get rid of the debt. We can't pay the debt. What do you think is going to happen, David?
Well, I would think that with the cancellation of the debt would be the cancellation of a whole world globalist banking system. That would be a total
rejection. I agree with you. But it will also cancel the paper assets. And we are now so addicted to paper assets, virtually everyone thinks the way to store your money is in a stock, a bond, a bank account, cash, whatever. We are addicted to paper and digital assets. But if if the debt can't be paid, they all disappear.
Well, there's no separation from any part of this delusion.
There's going to be separation in the foreseeable future. We're going to see a moment when people are forced to confront the difference between tangible wealth and paper wealth. And they aren't going to like it. It's going to be devastating and painful, and none of us will skate through unscathed. But those who store wealth in some tangible, like land, tools, guns, ammo, gold, silver, they're going to have the highest probability of getting through the difficulty that's headed our way.
Yeah, possession is 9/10 of the law.
Well, if you can find any place that honors the law anymore, I guess you're right. David, I want to thank you for your call. We've got another caller from Pennsylvania waiting, so if you don't mind, we'll break loose and talk to Jim from Pennsylvania.
No, much obliged.
Thank you, David.
Bye.
Well, Jim, are you there?
I'm there, Al. Hi, Melody. Yeah, the article that you had just read about when is the political manifestation going to become evident of the divergence between those that are the richer countries that are subsidizing their internal minority populations. That's already going on. You know, on September 18th of this year, the Scottish National Party is going to vote in a national referendum on independence from Great Britain.
Mm-hmm.
So it's already gone that far in Scotland and in the South Tyrol, which used to be Austria until after World War One. There, I have lots of family over there, even up into the government. That's a German-speaking area, and they're tired of subsidizing the Italians for the last 90 years. And
well, go ahead.
And that's just two. And that's just two regions. It's going on in the Spanish Basque region. It's going on in Flemish Belgium. It's going on in Corsica. So
yeah.
It's
going on here in the United States. It's going on here in the United States. There is at least a seemingly credible movement in California where they are talking about breaking California up into six states. Right?
That's right.
Now, and four of them will be impoverished, and two of them will be reasonably wealthy. And what that has to be is an attempt by the wealthy people to just say, we're tired of carrying the poor people. Let them fend for themselves.
The European Union is the new Roman Empire, the new, you know, Babylon, if you want to say. And just like you wanted to have a common language in Babylon, well, that was shattered. Now everybody individually wants to go back. The Italians want to go back to the lira. The Spanish want to go back to their currency. The French want to go back to the franc. Because the euro dollar, which was created just after World War II, is nothing but a bond based on the balance of deficit payments of the United States government after World War II. It's like the second use of a Kleenex.
That's not something I'm aware of. I didn't know that the euro. I didn't understand that the euro's origin goes back that far.
Very few people understand what the euro dollar, how it commenced, and what the purpose was to finance the rebuilding of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was busted. You know, financially after World War II, so it's one big bond based on the balance of deficits of the U.S. government. And, you know, it gained some credibility back maybe 15 years ago because they said, well, this country's throwing a little bit of gold behind it, and this other country's throwing a little bit of gold behind it. But basically, it's the second use of a Kleenex. I'm sorry for being naughty, but that's about the only way to describe it. And it's failed. And absolutely, I agree with that article.
I think all of these, I mean, the obvious, the point is fiat currencies always fail. And yet, no one learns anything from history, and everyone thinks that the next time around it'll be different, this time it'll work. And most people don't understand anything about the nature of money to begin with, and it makes them vulnerable to, I don't know, smooth-talking politicians and whatever. Smooth-talking bankers, and then you have the moment of, you know, reckoning when all of a sudden everybody goes, oh, my gosh, what has happened? What happened is we played the fool, and then we have to pay the fool's price.
Like our old friend Bob Chapman said, it's not going to work, and it isn't working, and it's ready to collapse. Now when you see these national movements all around the world, including in the United States. So hopefully I contributed something today, and thanks for the program.
Thanks very much for calling, Jim. Talk to you another time. Mm-hmm. All right, Melody, we've got 3-4 minutes left. Something you would like to add, or shall I search?
No, go ahead. I appreciate
all
the calls.
Bubbles.
Yeah, I appreciate
Let's talk about bubbles. What are bubbles? All right, we talk about bubbles in economics, and people say, oh, my gosh, we have a bubble. What they are is just an entire market, generally, where virtually every product in that market is significantly overpriced. That's all it is. A bubble is where something is overpriced. If a housing market goes into a bubble, most homes in the market will be selling for prices that are much higher than we might expect in a free market. If tech stocks go into a bubble, virtually all of the individual stocks in that particular market will be selling for irrationally high prices. Bubbles can occur in a particular nation's bond market, stock market, housing market, commodities markets. All bubbles have a single common denominator. They're overpriced. But how did we, and when we talk about being overpriced, we necessarily mean overpriced in relationship to something else. How, what is that something else? And the something else is the free market. We're essentially saying, look, we got a home here that's selling for $500,000, even though we know that on the free market, this house would probably only sell for $250,000. We have, if a house is $250,000 overpriced as compared to the free market, that tells us something. It tells us that when we are dealing with economic bubbles, we are not dealing with the free market. Someone is manipulating the free market. Someone is inflating this bubble and making prices larger, greater, more substantial than they would be if people just sat around, looked at a house, and, well, I think that house is worth about $250,000. We all agree. Yeah, that's about $250,000. Somebody comes in and by force of financial power or law, they say, no, it's not. It's worth $500,000. And if you buy it now, next year it might be worth $750,000. And the year after that it might be worth $1 million. And everybody gets into this thing. Point I'm trying to get to is this. Bubbles, just simple explanation, it simply indicates that a particular market or a particular item is overpriced. And when the bubble is there and it's sustained by artificial means, it means that the government and or the central bank, which is the Federal Reserve, have created laws and or policies to artificially stimulate that price. And they always pop and they always fail. And they always go back down to where the free market wants them to be. And, for example, we're looking at the stock market right now. Stock market's hit a high, 16,400 or thereabouts. They've fallen down recently. They've had a little decline. Insofar as the stock market has been artificially supported by government policies of releasing of quantitative easing, injecting billions of dollars to the banks, to the government, in theory, reaching out and helping to support the stock market, we have a bubble. It's artificially overpriced. Inevitably, the bubble will fail, and when it does, it will fall back where? It'll fall back to a free market price. Bubbles are being blown by the government and or the Federal Reserve. We're out of time. I want to thank all of you for listening. I'm Alfred Addis here with Melody Cedarstrom on Financial Survival. We'll be back tomorrow. Hope you will tune in at that time. In the meantime, the good Lord bless you, me, Melody, and Frank, the producer.
Bye-bye. Bye.